Music, thoughts, hopes and dreams. Four terrific ingredients for the East Coast's latest audio offering, with singer-songwriter Pamela Sue Mann and Alex Levchuk opening an audacious audio assembly of talent for New York Real Talk.
When you have a discography which includes Bruce Springsteen, Avril Lavigne, Jonathan Brooke, and of course the fabulous, awesomely wonderful Suzanne Vega, you've already earned your place in the Rock Hall of Fame. When you have basically gotten this sort of inspiration that indeed our first official guest for episode one of New York Real Talk is concerned, you have to say, without any further ado, Michael Visaglia, welcome to New York Real Talk. How are you, sir?
I am well, and I'm in New York, and I'm honored today to be your guest.
Well, we're equally honored, and you can tell that the co-founder of, indeed, New York Real Talk was so impressed with the whole thing, she wanted to hold back her entrance. So she said, let Alex do the introduction. Once that's done, then I'll join, and then all will be well. So, Pamela Sue Mann, welcome to your show, of course, our show.
Hello, Pamela. Very regal entrance, I have to say.
Classic. It's classic. Michael, thank you so much for being on this show.
I'm very happy. I was just saying that I'm honored and thrilled. So,
the first official guest. We had an episode zero as a pilot episode, which was just overly expanded with all sorts of things. But you are our first authentic New Yorker and first official guest. So rightly so from that point of view. It's great.
Well, I mean, all yours. So whatever you want to talk about or ask, feel free.
Well, let's go back to 1976, when, as I said, Jimmy Carter's president, the Olympic Games is taking place in the country, and a young Mike Visaglia is making your first steps in terms of the musical journey that's brought us into the 21st century. I mean, when you think back to those days, was it a simpler time? Was it an easier time? Was it a time where you thought, this is for me, this is my life?
Well, I knew it was going to be my life way before that. My father was a musician, and I was kind of groomed to being the professional that he wasn't. But I'm a native New Yorker. I was born in the East Village of New York. And being here my whole life, I'm still here. Being here my whole life was a gift that, it was like being in the most magical place at the most magical time. That's what I feel about it. I feel like I was really born at the right time because, I was exposed to lots and lots of multiculturalism, lots and lots of inclusivity. In the 70s in New York were a tough time politically, and it was, there were a lot of crime. There was a lot of crime. There was a lot of grime. There was a lot of dirt. There were a lot of, there were sanitation strikes and, lots of unrest politically, especially in the early 70s with the end of the Vietnam War, which I fortunately missed, even though I did have a draft card, which is quite something. I did have one. And fortunately, the war ended before they called my number. There you have it.
Were you ever tempted to do that line of burning the draft card and actually sort of burn it in force as a protest? Or was it a case of, I'll go, what the hey?
Oh, no. I certainly didn't want to go. And I'm glad I would never have. I don't have the constitution for that kind of thing. And I'm certainly glad it never happened. I was so immersed in trying to direct my life toward music and art and creativity that it was there, but it was kind of on my periphery. Once in a while it imposed itself, but I wasn't overburdened with it. I didn't really know what I would have done, but fortunately, I did. The gods intervened. It was, I think, probably the most creative decade to be in New York City. You had the flourishing of so many overlapping art forms, not only not only film and visual arts painting and some of the great mavericks of our time, but you also had an amazing music, different styles of music that were going on essentially 24/7. You could just take a small snapshot of what was happening at CBGB's, with, the advent of the punk scene and, going to see, Patti Smith, Television, the Ramones, all of these, the Police, and lots of other bands that were, made their start there. But you also had, if that wasn't your thing, you had disco. Disco was huge in the mid to late 70s. And there were lots of disco clubs. There was a thriving Latin scene where you can go uptown in the Bronx and other areas and in Harlem. And you had a tremendous soul R&B scene that reflected itself in its own fashions, which were fantastic. You also had the avant-garde jazz scene that was really, really alive, that manifested itself in what were called loft concerts, which a lot of the preeminent players had lofts, which were easily attainable back then when they didn't cost $10 million, and they were rented. So you had these large spaces, and a lot of times in order to pay their monthly rent, they would throw rent parties where they would play. So I used to go see people like, Ornette Coleman or Sam Rivers with your countryman, Dave Holland on bass, and lots of other fantastic players. And they would, you could go there, bring a bottle of wine and, spend $5 to contribute toward the rent. And you could watch great music for hours and interact with the players. And it was, it was just such a free scene that I was so enamored and ensconced in, trying to find my way and also have contact with all of these different things, that it was just the most wonderful place to be in the 70s.
If you were to genetically splice Kate Bush with Deborah Harry from that time, you'd probably get Pamela Sue Mann if you sort of genetically put it together.
Wow, you know what? You are so right, and I hadn't thought of that, and now I will think about her differently for the rest of my days.
Comment. Well, there were two things about it. I was shocked to hear that you got a draft card. You're far too young for that. You're lying. You're fibbing.
You are sadly mistaken on that front. But
second thing is, I remember when I met Mike, and I can't even remember how long ago it was now. It was quite some time ago. The big thing about Mike, and everyone was like, Mike, you were the first musician I ever met that didn't have another job. It was like, oh yeah, Mike, did you know Mike never had another job outside of music? And it was like the story about Mike Visaglia was, Mike, no other job ever besides music Visaglia.
Well, it's true. I think about that once in a while, and from my perspective, I take it for granted. But then, when I meet all these other great musicians and friends of mine, and they, they tell me their stories, very, very few of them never had another job, even the early days when, they were finding their way and, supporting their art. But I guess I had, kind of a combination of just enough talent and just enough obliviousness about the world that I just went about my business and just, pursued and was successful enough that I didn't have another job. And it's always been about music and playing the bass for me. Yeah.
That's incredible.
I'm really impressed. If we just move through the decades a wee bit to Solitude Standing. There any particular tracks on that album which you think, actually, these are the ones that stand out for me? And at the time, you kind of felt, yep, I think Suzanne Vega is cooking with gas now.
Well, I go back a little prior to that, when I got recommended to audition for her. That was in 1985, which was 2 years before Solitude Standing. And I didn't appear on the first album, but I got asked to join the touring band to tour for the first album. And You know, I knew something special was happening, but it was hard to imagine that, like, that particular style of, you know, observational, confessional, poetic lyricism, with that, you know, unmistakable voice, was going to be as big worldwide as it wound up being. So it was great to see that. You know, we would start out, when we started out, it was like very small time touring, you know, and playing like cafes and small performance room, all either in a van or an RV, you know, traveling around the country. But what was amazing, well, especially in Europe at that time, was that every time we went back to a city that we had that we had visited prior, it was bigger, and we went back and it was bigger. And we went back and it was bigger, and it just kept getting bigger. And you know, then when Solitude Standing came out, it was like the explosion heard around the world. And I'm really, really happy that I got to play on every track on that album. And there was a lot of forethought, a lot of time was given to the players on that record to come up with, you know, their own parts and really kind of add to the aesthetic of that record. So it's actually, when I think of that record, it's like every song to me, obviously Luca, because it was such a gigantic hit and, you know, was Grammy nominated for Song of the Year in America and was number three in the country, in
His
America.
name is Luca. He lives on the second floor.
Just don't.
Yeah, he certainly did. And a story like that, which is so kind of out of the ordinary for a hit song. It'd be hard to imagine that kind of thing ever becoming a hit again, you know, with the sensibility of the times we live in. But it was remarkable. And I remember when we were recording that album, like I said, we had a lot of time, which is something that a lot of performers don't have these days. It's sort of like, you know, get in there, do your thing, you know, budgets are tight, do your best job and get out. But we had weeks to prepare, weeks of rehearsals and meetings and, you know, talking about the songs and coming up with ideas and trying different things. And it was great when we realized we hit upon, you know, the right thing. And I remember going in, and when we recorded Luca, it was initially just the drummer, Steve Ferrer, who unfortunately is no longer with us, but just the drummer Steve Ferrer and myself. We went in there and worked on like what was going to be the groove for this, what was going to be the motor underneath this song, and we tried a bunch of different things, just the two of us, and eventually we came upon a thing that we really liked, and we recorded it, and that became kind of the bed track for the whole rest of the production. And I'm really proud of a lot of the stuff that I played on and what everybody played on that record. There were a lot of unique contributions that reflected the talents of the various people involved.
I was talking to my students today, as I'm prone to do as an academic. I know it's crazy, but I do talk to
Well,
my
I hope
students.
that you do talk to them.
And we got talking
What
about the way in which
class
music is
is appearance?
consumed. It's interesting insofar as the notion of actually purchasing an album seems to have vanished, that actually they like a song, they'll download it, they'll literally just listen to the single. Do you feel, I mean, this is really a question for both yourself, Mike, and Pamela. Do you feel as though that whole notion of the concept album, we've kind of lost something insofar as, you know, there was always a case of you might buy the album and you might not like all the tracks, but you like two or three of them, etc. Has that whole sort of aspect of the business changed? So it now is a case of you need to strike it with just the one song and it goes from that basis.
You wanna field that one, Pamela?
Well, it's interesting. I have noticed that it has changed, you know, as someone who is writing and recording always on a shoestring. I'm so much so that I've actually gotten up to the point of like mastering on my own. I not necessarily very well, but I have actually done that. I think it's much more affordable for artists to be able to just conceive of a song, write it, even like record the little video on your iPhone and get it to the point where you release it just on your own. So it puts a lot of autonomy in the hands of songwriters, singer-songwriters. At the same time, there's nothing like a good concept album. Conceptual albums are little worlds, and anyone that experienced a vinyl when vinyl was the thing, you know, these concept albums are entire universes you step into. You know, of course, you have to turn the record at the end of side A to side B. There's that interruption, but you know, you're looking at the artwork writ large, and it's a wonderful world to climb into. I do think that it's really up to the artist in terms of if you string things together and they're in a significant enough time period of your life, chances are they probably would fit into an album with a body of work. And I know that really clever bands, you know, are and artists are still thinking in terms of concept album, are still thinking in terms of long form. But really, we live in a society, in a global society, that the attention span is so short. We're so inundated constantly with stuff, and we don't have that attention span that we used to have. So the kids today, it's just about the song. Now that said, there are kids. I know my daughter just got a 1970s record player from Jerry, got it, fixed it up, and she's just bought a bunch of albums, vinyl, which are so expensive now. But they're listening. She just listened to the Mamas and the Papas and Harry Nilsson and ABBA and My Bloody Valentine and Joy Division on vinyl. So I don't know, Michael, what do you think about that?
I don't want to sound like the old curmudgeon that's
No, I want you to.
That's completely out of touch.
Michael, you don't have a spittoon to actually spit into and say, "You young pups over there, you don't realize what's going on these days."
How do you know what's over here on my right side here?
Country accent.
By the way, excuse me. No, never mind. Because I'm still a very active musician, and I haven't, despite what people might guesstimate as my age, I've not slowed down kind of a whit, and I don't intend to, so that's a good thing.
William Shatner could go into space at age 90, there's a long time for you to go, Mike.
Right, I know. God, did you see him crying on TV? That was quite something. But to get back to the point, my biggest regret, and I understand that times have changed, attention spans have changed with younger generation, and they have so many more things to be distracted by than we did growing up. We didn't have the internet, we didn't have 7,000 TV channels, we didn't have a million computer games. We didn't have all of this stuff to take our attention. We had, seven channels on television. We had movies.
You might have had seven channels in Britain. It was only three.
Yeah, it's true. There wasn't a lot. But the thing that I miss the most is that the album as concept, I think, is a wonderful thing, but it's, and there's no buts about it, but I love the fact that it demanded interaction. Like Pamela was saying, you had to get up and turn the record over. It wasn't wallpaper the way a lot of music is these days. It's just kind of, people listen to not even a WAV file or not even a beautiful sounding recording. They're listening to MP3s on little earbuds, tiny speakers the size of like pinpoints, and the immersive experience of setting aside time and listening to an artist's complete statement that they make, not only the oral aural statement, but I'm talking about the visual statement of the album cover art and the graphics. And, going over, I used to just love going over the minutiae of what the record was about, finding out who all the players were, when it was recorded, where it was recorded, looking at the insert pictures and the gatefolds that were, that sometimes used to pop up, and the cover art. And, I was thrilled by that company, Hypnosis, that, British company that did a lot of the Pink Floyd and Yes albums. These were beautiful works of art, and I miss the, and I used to get together with my friends. It used to be like an experience of like, let's get together and listen to these records today, and it would take up the day, and we would listen to it, look at it, pass it around, and they were beautiful sounding. Vinyl is a beautiful sounding medium, and looking at the cover work and discussing it, with your friends was just a joyous thing that I think is, kind of a lost art, and I regret that part of it, because I think that we artists, Pamela, myself, and all of our friends, we put in a lot of time with this stuff, and we would hope that it would be taken as seriously as any other art form, and we don't want it to be background music.
And perhaps it's symptomatic as well. If you take something like Jeff Wayne's War of the Worlds, can you imagine that actually being made in the current climate? And yet it lasts. It's got a longevity. You listen to the way in which Phil Lynott, Richard Burton, Jeff Wayne, Justin Haywood, etc., the kind of tracks that come through with that, it kind of all the things you've just described kind of fit into that kind of album thing, which you can obviously listen to via MP3, you can listen to it via CD, you can listen to Liam Neeson as opposed to Richard Burton. So lots of things are changed around with that. But again, it's interesting that there is a certain, I'll say again, longevity in terms of the quality of the work that's actually there. Commodification is a dangerous thing.
Well, I think whether the audience or listener or whoever hears it or recognizes it like consciously or not, when you have art of substance, I think that's going to be reflected in longevity, and it's also going to be reflected in how it resonates on some level with a listener, whether they're like aware of it or not. There something goes deeper that, you know, that says to them consciously or unconsciously that there's something really good going on here that's worthy of my attention. And I think that's what the longevity thing that you're talking about is. There are, you know, we could name dozens and dozens of records that are going to live much past our lives.
I like to feel Ouch will do that personally, and certainly Cake as well. But still, that's another one from that. Mike, New York born and bred. What did it feel like getting together with that boy from New Jersey, Bruce Springsteen? Because I gather there's a certain tension between New York and New Jersey. Were there ever any moments where you thought, what am I doing here?
Let me qualify that. I was not actually in the room with him when we recorded that record. We recorded one song for his idol, Pete Seeger's record, where Bruce sang the chorus. Pete sang the verses. Bruce sang the choruses. I played the bass. And I think a lot of this was done separately because of, you know.
Because of New York and New Jersey, presumably. It's the tension, no doubt.
Yeah, I'm not going to New Jersey. And I told him that. He told me I'm not coming to New York. No. I didn't actually have experienced that tension. Fortunately, I know a few people that are in his band and that only speak extremely lovingly and reverentially about him. So it's a wonderful thing. And I'm just glad that my name is somewhat in the smallest of ways associated with him.
He is the boss. So would you like to just share the track you were actually part of?
You know what? I can't because I don't even remember the name of it.
Well, there you go.
I'd have to search around on the latest Pete Seeger records to find out the one that you might be able to Google it. Find out the one that he sang with the boss, and that would be the one, that track that appeared on his record. But I don't remember the name of the track. Unfortunately, okay. I should.
We'll work our way through that. It's okay.
I you can find it. I think the technology exists these days that it's probably within 7 seconds it can be found.
Hey, we shall overcome. We shall overcome. We shall overcome someday. Darling, here in my heart, yeah, I do believe we shall overcome someday. We'll walk in. We'll walk hand in hand. Here we shall overcome. We shall overcome. We shall overcome someday. Darling, in my heart, I do believe we shall overcome someday. We shall overcome someday.
Pamela, questions from yourself.
Well, there were a few things, actually. I mean, one had to do with favorite projects that you've been involved in. But there's one thing that I don't want to forget about, so I must mention this before we go to that. Sorry about the dinging. There is a story that I heard from another person, not from Michael, but it is a phenomenal story, and I did fact check it with Mike to make sure that it is indeed true. And not only is it true, but he sent me the little newspaper clip, and I believe I sent it to you, Alex, as well. Would you like to talk about this very artistic series of moments?
this elevated pitch that's actually there, which is a whole new term on an elevation, really.
Well, you know, this goes back to the 70s again, which we were talking about how kind of free it was, and how, you know, if you were an artist, there were a lot of things that you can kind of get yourself involved in. So one of my friends at the time was a performance artist who did a lot of really, really interesting things, not only a performance artist, but he was also a painter and a graffiti artist. And, you know, he did a lot of very interesting and important things back in the early 70s. So he came up with this idea. And this was going to be like an ultimate performance art New York experience. He came up with this idea that first of all, he took a map and over that map of that looked over the entire island of Manhattan. And what he saw in the map was that there were 7 major bridges that kind of, if you look at them in the right way, kind of actually made the shape of the number 7. And I believe there are 7 colors of the rainbow. Am I mistaken with that? And he came up with this idea that why don't we, him and a bunch of his friends that he was going to organize, why don't let's do this performance art piece where various people were going to have a color of the rainbow jumpsuit. And they were going to be assisted in climbing up all of the 7 bridges all the way up to the tippy top. And then they were going to shoot off a smoke flare reflecting the color of their jumpsuit that they were wearing. And it was going to make this huge, you know, artistic statement, which I thought was extremely exciting at the time. So a bunch of us, he organized a whole bunch of... you know, like-minded miscreants, me being one of them. And it was a multi-day kind of organized, premeditated effort where we knew we were going to get legal trouble. So he actually retained a lawyer for us, and he actually tipped off the news that this was going to happen. So he would, you know, maximize his coverage of this. And then we spent the entire day before and night, you know, hand dyeing the jumpsuits to the specific color, and synchronizing our watches, you know, in a time before cell phones and the internet, and then, you know, driving off to the various bridges in Manhattan. And I was assigned as a facilitator to, I believe it was the Manhattan Bridge. There is a bridge called the Manhattan Bridge. And then at a certain time, we all jumped off right in the middle of the bridge, in the middle of the traffic, in the middle of rush hour on a morning, and jumped over the side, jumped over the banisters, and went to the ladders that went all the way up to the top of the bridge, and helped our friend, who I wasn't a climber, thankfully, and helped our friend start to ascend. And of course, we were most of us, in fact, all of us except one person, was intercepted by the law, by the police, and brought into, you know, a holding cell. But
Mike, why didn't you just say it was because you weren't actually in time to go to Vietnam? You wanted to practice some of that thrill experience. You wanted that experience of diving off bridges and so on.
I didn't have the presence of mind. It might have had something to do with the lack of sleep at that point, but I didn't have the presence of mind to say that. But my friend Jack, who is a very active and wonderful and accomplished musician, Jack Bashkow, is a saxophone and reed player, multi-reed player, made it all the way up to the very tippy top of the Brooklyn Bridge. And there is a picture on the cover of the newspaper, I believe it is 1977, of him on top of the Brooklyn Bridge playing a piccolo with helicopters surrounding him up top. And so that was as far as we got, but it was quite an experience. And then, of course, you know, fortunately, it was in the days before terrorism. Otherwise, we would have all been shot, and they would have found us in the various rivers around Manhattan. But
don't go there, Mike. You know, it's not worthwhile. It was, you know, it was of its time, clearly.
Or we would have wound up in jail for many, many years. But fortunately, our lawyer, our intrepid lawyer, got us all off.
And don't get me started on the health and safety issues, because that's a whole new world entirely.
Well, you know, there was a lot going on back then, you know, a lot to think about.
Sorry. So. Thank you so much for sharing it with us. It's hysterical. do we have time for this, Alex? Because
we have a couple more minutes. I mean, I've just been looking at know your bass player, Mike Visaglia, and I noticed Christopher Cross, Bette Midler, and Phoebe Snow also appearing
I did play with all of them and got to know them. Yeah, that's true. That was very fortunate. Actually, the only one of those three that I toured with was Christopher Cross. I spent about almost a year touring with him around the country. And
persistently hum Arthur's theme then?
Well, we had to play it every night for sure. That's for sure.
It's the best that you can do.
I mean, it won an Oscar. How can you not play that song every night? It literally is an Oscar winning song. So, but he's a very nice guy. He's extremely thoughtful. I had a lot of nice experiences with him. He's still sounds exactly the way he sounded in the 70s.
He's got that runs like the wind.
And yeah, that's right. He's got that angelic high voice. What I didn't realize about him until I started playing with him was what a virtuoso guitar player he is. He's literally he throws it down on guitar. I mean, that guy's got a lot of skills, and he shows them off every night. So it was great to know that part of him.
Well, we've heard Suzanne Vega, Luca. We've heard, obviously, Chris Cross. We can go with probably Run Like the Wind. What is your own favourite track you'd like us to feature on this particular piece? Is there a moment where you actually think, do you know, I really enjoyed that one?
Yeah, let's go with one of Suzanne's tracks called Wooden Horse. Yeah, let's go with that one. I really enjoyed that.
What was wood became light.
So, and of course, we were thinking at the time, we were thinking of like, let's make this sort of like a Peter Gabriel-ish kind of track. So I was kind of doing my, you know, my little interpretation of what Tony Levin, the great bass player, might do, you know, filtered through my sensibility. And so I like that because it's a wonderful and mysterious track, and it's based on a real story. So I dig that one a lot.
Fantastic. You've been listening to New York Real Talk. We have our special guest for edition one, the first official edition one, Mike Visaglia. Pamela, it's been awesome from my point of view at the other side of the Atlantic, sharing some things, even with a slightly iffy Zoom connection, but that's where I happen to be at present. Pamela, any closing thoughts that you'd like to raise with Mike?
Well, firstly, I want to say thank you for choosing that song because I wrote it down. It's so strange. Absolutely adore that song.
You know, great minds think alike. That's what they say, right?
Yeah. And we did call each other and say, what color are you wearing, you know, for the Zoomer? And, you know, of course, we're in New York. So,
And Pamela, as I said, the genetic offspring of Kate Bush and Deborah Harry. It's Pamela Sue Mann. There we are.
I wore the state colors. I always wear my flag colors, total black. So that's the New York, the city colors, rather. That's the New York City colors.
Absolutely. Should I pose a question?
Go on for it. We've got time for one last question. Go for it.
Have you had a reasonably good Zoomer with Alex and myself today?
Oh, I enjoyed this. This is the highlight of my day. Are you kidding me? This is wonderful. I'm so happy that you guys asked me to do this. And I hope you have many, many, many more of these with lots of interesting people. So good luck with all of this.
Thank you for being
here. Return, Mike. Will you come back on the show?
Anytime you want. Anytime. Call me. I have I can regale you with stories for hours.
Actually, I think that you should take my place, my spot.
No, come on. You know, there's got to be somebody attractive to look at.
Yeah. It hurts, Mike. It hurts, but it's true. You know, that's the bottom line. You know,
I'm just going to go stare at my draft card for a while, so I'll see you guys at some point.
Mike Visaglia, huge thanks for being part of episode one of New York Real Talk. Pamela, we'll be back with you again, obviously, very shortly. It is your show. So, Pamela, would you like to have a closing sort of farewell?
Farewell. I've been the same. I don't know the words.
Adieu.
Music, thoughts, hopes and dreams. Four terrific ingredients for the East Coast's latest audio offering with singer-songwriter Pamela Sue Mann and Alex Levchuk opening an audacious audio assembly of talent for New York Real Talk.